it's one of those things where I've had people say, that doesn't sound like common sense to me. And they've said that quite often, and I would always just smile and say, no one said that taxes are logical or fair.
Whether you put it off until the last minute or you jump on the process as soon as you see your W-2 form, tax season can be stressful for anyone. Hi, I'm Steve Fast. Welcome to Random Acts of Knowledge, presented by Heartland Community College, where we talk to experts who pass on some things we may not know. In this case, we'll talk about taxes. One thing before we move forward, our expert knows an awful lot about taxes, but you should consider this interview a good starting point. This interview is not tax advice and is not intended for purposes of avoiding tax penalties that may be imposed on any taxpayer. The information we discuss is general in nature and based on authorities that are subject to change. Heartland Community College guarantees neither the accuracy nor completeness of any information and is not responsible for any errors that might be included in this edited interview. Now that we're nice and legal, we all have a lot of questions about taxes, including if we should do them ourselves or hire a professional, like our guest.
I'm Paul Kelson, and I'm instructor of accounting at Heartland Community College.
When it comes to taxes, how much of your instruction in accounting to your students has to do with the kind of things you would have to do to understand your taxes or taxes for a business?
Well, the first basic accounting courses are helping you understand how to gather the information for the tax return, how to make the adjusting entries and everything that's needed to have accurate information for the tax return. Then we are starting some new classes this fall, which are actually how to prepare the tax return and how to plan for doing income taxes, helping businesses pay the least amount of tax.
I think everybody wants to pay the least amount of tax, pretty much. When it comes to an individual, this is something that around tax season, you see a lot of advertisements from tax preparers saying, hey, come in and get the best refund. We'll help you out. And as one gets older and they gain more assets and maybe their taxes become more complicated, how does a person decide when they should seek professional help for preparing taxes? Some people seek professional help for taxes just because they don't like doing them, but other people might be out of their depth. How do you start to make that determination if you should hire someone?
Well, the tax laws change consistently. I know when I was in practice, we would get emails every day of revenue rulings, court cases, everything was happening. Not that every email affected my clients, very few did. But there was always changes going every day. I don't remember a day where we didn't get at least one change. But then last year, there was a major change. Actually, I'd say probably a year and a half ago. And it was for this tax return that we're doing this year. And it was a major change, probably the largest change since 1986 during the Reagan era. And there's been so many changes that if you have any kind of business, rental property, farm, even specialty credits like education credit, earned income credit, someone with lower income. And obviously, if you have dependents, everything kind of changed. And so if you're willing to try to keep up with the change, or if you're willing to allow something like a TurboTax to ask you the right questions, fine. The problem is, maybe they don't know what question applies to you, or maybe you don't know how to answer a question.
That raises an interesting question for somebody that's even looking for a professional's assistance in doing their taxes. Now, I'm sure if you go into a local office or one of those chain offices, they'll tell you what you need to bring in. But you might as well kind of have a leg up. What sort of things does a person need to gather when they're preparing the taxes for themselves, or what documents do they need to bring for a preparer?
That's a good question. When you're talking about wages, interest, things like that, most everybody gets their W-2s and 1099s by about the 1st of February. By then, pretty much everything should be out. But if you have rental property, there's a lot more than 1099s. Yes, you might get a 1099 for the income portion of it, but what about all those expenses? And it really starts way before you're getting ready to do your taxes. It starts at least a year before because you have to have good records. And so you've spent money all year long. And if you don't have good records showing how you spent the money, you know, one of the big things I used to always say is if you have rental property or if you have a business or you have even just a little business on the side, you shouldn't be using your own personal checking account to make those expenditures. It's just a lot cleaner to have a separate checking account. Something that's just as simple as that. Yeah, there's a lot of things that you need to plan ahead. For me, when I was in business, it wasn't the preparation of the tax return. To me, it was the planning, making sure I get a chuckle, get the big refund. Of course, I started back in the late 70s, and we went through the 80s when interest rates hit 20%. Well, I made sure clients didn't get a big refund for that particular reason. They might as well be taking that money each week and sticking it in a CD earning 15, 20% of interest. But over the years, as interest rates dropped, it wasn't such a big concern. But still, it's just the idea that letting the government use your money. I've always been one that owes the government a little bit at the end of every year. I try to make sure that I don't get a penalty. Obviously, you know, you can't owe too much, but I always like to owe a little. But more on the planning is not the refund. The planning is more that we've taken advantage of all the deductions. And not only that, but we haven't purchased equipment we didn't need, or we haven't purchased things we didn't need just to let the tail wag the dog, so to speak. You know, if you make all your decisions based on income tax, that's not good because you might overspend. But at the same time, if there's something you could do timing-wise this year versus next year, or this year versus 3 years down the road, or retirement planning, estate planning, planning to me was way more important than the preparation.
Something else you mentioned just a little bit ago when you were talking about different kinds of income, you mentioned rental income. Now, rental income is different than other kinds of income sometimes when it comes to taxes, right?
The main difference between rental income and business income you owe not only income tax, but you owe what's called self-employment tax, which is the same thing as what you get withheld in a paycheck for called Social Security and Medicare. The rental property is considered an investment. It's not a business per se, so you don't pay any Social Security tax on it. But it does have categories of expenses listed on the return. And that's a good place to start and look and say, oh, I see that they allow me, you know, repairs and maintenance, cleaning, supplies, real estate taxes, insurance, all these categories. But not only that, keeping track of your mileage to go to the rental property to work on it, postage to mail out your bills or correspondence. There's just a lot of things that you need to keep track of.
When it comes to something like mileage, let's say that you have to drive somewhere. You mentioned keeping a separate account. Is that the only way you can keep track of mileage? You just can't go, I know that on March 12th of the previous year, I drove 25 miles. Is that good enough for the IRS?
What they want is they want a log. And in that log, they preferably, you would have the odometer reading when you left the house or where your office and the odometer reading when you got back. And that would be, the difference would be the amount of miles that you spent on that trip. That would be what they prefer. If you would just make sure you document when you go and how long, how far it is, you probably would be all right. Sometimes it's helpful, like if you went to Menards and picked up some supplies and then went over the rental house and did some repair work, it would be helpful to document that bill with the trip. To again justify why did I drive to the rental property. And the IRS does have a mileage rate that they allow you. You don't have to keep track of gas or anything like that.
Now, do they make that information easy to find for the average person, the mileage rate and things like that? I imagine that if you are a tax preparer for a living, you have a cheat sheet or something where you know all those things by heart or you know the rate. But if you are just an average person, and you're like, I need to find this out. Is it easy to find?
Oh, yeah. Just like anything else, you can Google it. You can probably Google business mileage rate per the IRS. There are different types of mileage rates, so you do have to be careful. There's a medical mileage rate, there's a charity mileage rate, and there's a business mileage rate. But it's fairly simple to find, yes.
So let's talk a little bit about other kinds of income. We mentioned rental income, mentioned that people might have a side business. Some people pick up little side businesses I think to a lot of people, it doesn't feel like starting a business. Who knows? Maybe they're making some sort of craft and selling it online, or they are selling some sort of product. You see people do this all the time now and add a little extra income. Do people need to be particularly careful when they're doing this? Is there a certain amount of money that they don't need to worry about it so much, and maybe other amounts of money is where they do? I know that probably the IRS is saying, yes, if you make income, you need to report it. But how should people approach that?
Okay. Technically, anything you receive as income has to be reported. You'll hear people say, oh, that's just a hobby. I don't have to report that. If you were to read technically what hobby is according to the IRS, a hobby is if you happen to receive any income for your hobby, it's all income with no expense. You would have to deduct the expenses as what we call an itemized deduction subject to some limits. So I always tried to make sure that my clients did not have hobby businesses. Now, the IRS also has a rule that says if your side business does not show a profit at least twice out of 7 years, 2 years out of 7 years, it's a hobby. Some people look at it and say, well, hobby, that's good. I looked at it and said, hobby, that's bad. I do not want my business classified as a hobby, because then the IRS has a chance at all my income and none of my expenses. So that's always been kind of a contention. People have a misunderstanding there. It's one of those things where I've had people say, that doesn't sound like common sense to me. And they've said that quite often, and I would always just smile and say, no one said that taxes are logical or fair.
Some people have kids and they want them to start earning their own money when they can. It might be as simple as mowing lawns, or it might be more like you go somewhere and you're going to get a W-2. When should teenagers that are starting to earn money start to worry about taking track of that sort of thing? Maybe if a kid goes out and mows for an entire summer and makes several hundred dollars, they might not even think if that's a taxable thing. When do they need to worry about that?
That's a good question. The IRS has rules on how much you can earn without filing an income tax return. It changes with the tax law changes. And to give you that number just off the top of my head, I would have to say it's mainly the deductions that you are allowed. Used to be it was the standard deduction only, because a child is claimed as a dependent by the parent. Well, there is no dependency deduction anymore, so it's probably still the standard deduction, but I wouldn't want to say that for sure under the new law, because things have changed. So if it is a standard deduction, you could tell a child, well, you could make up to, you know, almost $6,000 without doing a federal income tax return. The problem is if it's self-employed income. Now we're in a whole different situation, and that is self-employed income is subject to Social Security. And so at that point, you have to beware, because once you hit $400 of net income, income minus your expenses, you have self-employment income. So that was always the one that kind of tripped people up, was, like you said, the mowing the neighbor's lawns and things like that. Now, there are some other rules that exempt certain ages from Social Security. And again, that's why you almost need a tax preparer. It used to be, back when I came out of school, we tried to memorize as much of this as possible. To tell you the truth, we just know where to look now. I always told them, when the parents would say something, I'd say, you know, the government's never going to take more than about 30% of a child's income. The Social Security is 15%. It used to be that the lower bracket was 15. Well, now the lower bracket's 10 and 12. So they'll never pay more than about 25%. Unless they really get into a business. So it's not like they're going backwards by earning the money. They get to keep 75% of it. And there's the age-old thing that when you're not dealing with businesses, when you're dealing with individuals, there is no recording of income by, or, you know, the expense by the individual. And so some people will say, well, I didn't get a 1099. Why should I report that income? Well, for the simple reason that it's income. That's all I can say.
Let's talk a little bit about other reasons people might have to do their return differently than the previous year, or that they might still want to go out and hire somebody to do it. Major life changes. You get married?
Getting married, having children, a death in the family, divorce. And that became a little more complicated with the new law because the income tax for divorcees changed pretty majorly under the new law. So yes, you're right. Any of these life-changing type things, so divorce, death, marriage, children, education, going to school, going back to school, all of those have tax repercussions.
If you pay alimony, that's something that you used to be able to deduct and you don't now? Is that what the change was?
The change was, it used to be that if there was true alimony, and this was always the case, the definition of alimony is very, very tight. And a lot of people would get tripped up here. You always had to have a good attorney that knew what was alimony and what was settlement and so on. But if it was true alimony, the person who paid the alimony got to deduct it, and the person who received the alimony had to show it as income. Typically, the way alimony was set up, a higher income person paid alimony to a lower income person. So it really worked out fairly good in the long run because the higher paid person actually got more money as a tax reduction than the person who paid it in. Under the new law, there is no alimony deduction anymore. So it's gone.
Other things that people might not think of, or they certainly don't anticipate for it. You mentioned there's a death in the family. You might inherit something. Somebody might leave you some money. They might leave you some property. Those are all things where you have to pay special attention and think about that as how you report some of that. I think there are some exemptions, right?
What you have to distinguish between here is when you get an endowment or if you get a bequest, the assets that you get are not income, okay? But the income off those assets become income. And so what tends to happen when you're doing this planning, anymore, it's up over $5 million now that you can transfer between individuals. So what happened here in the Midwest was those who owned farm ground really got themselves into a bind from the standpoint that something that maybe cost them $1,000 or $2,000 an acre now all of a sudden was $10,000 or $12,000 an acre. So they had to really do some planning to make sure they didn't get over those limits. But they're high enough that most people don't have to worry about paying the estate tax. But where they are over the $5 million, yes, you want to plan so that you pay no estate tax. There's really no reason. Even the big estates, billions of dollars, they do a lot of planning to try to keep as much of it as out of the estate as possible. Gifting is one way to keep it out of the estate. But again, you can only gift, I believe, that just went up to maybe $15,000 a person that you can gift to in a year. Well, a family of mom and dad, and let's say two children, and both the children married. If the dynamics of the family are such that it's okay to give to the spouse, mom can give four people $14,000. That's $56,000. Dad can give four people $14,000 a year. That's $56,000. So you can move $100,000 pretty quickly each year. That's an annual thing. But as far as if you get a bequest, then the income off of that, you have to start paying income tax on. The asset, you didn't have to pay tax on. And even if you get something over $5 million, it's the estate that pays the tax, not the individual getting the money. Same way with a gift. If dad and mom give too much money to the children don't pay the tax. It's dad and mom that pay the tax.
Who can do taxes for somebody else? You've got your CPAs. You've got your tax attorneys. And then who else are prepared and or licensed to do taxes professionally?
Okay. Actually, anyone can do income tax. All that is required at this point in time is that you sign the return if you are a paid preparer. There was a push about 5 years ago, and the IRS says, we don't like these unregistered tax preparers. We're going to come up with something new called a registered tax preparer. And everybody has to be registered if they're going to sign an income tax return. Well, the courts said that was not constitutional. So what you have is anybody can prepare a tax return, and if they're paid for it, they just have to sign it. But if the client ends up going through an audit or the IRS requests information, or you end up going through appeals, or you end up going to court, then the person who prepared the return, unless they're one of three types of people, they cannot represent that client. And as you mentioned, it's attorneys, CPAs, and enrolled agents. What is an enrolled agent? An enrolled agent is a certification provided by the Internal Revenue Service. And it's been around probably since the tax code started in 1913, which is an interesting thing. A lot of people say, well, you mean we haven't paid income taxes before 1913? I said, no. Most of our income was from tariffs prior to 1913. And nobody ever heard about tariffs until just recently. And of course, obviously, we're not looking at the money from tariffs. We're using them for leverage for everything else. So income tax is still our major tax. The enrolled agent has been around a very long time, but what tended to happen was the CPA became the go-to tax preparer because they understood the business. They were doing the business planning and they were auditing the books from a financial standpoint. Not when you talk about an audit, most people think of an IRS audit, that they're looking at your taxes. Well, in the financial world, especially the bigger companies, there's something called a financial audit where you get an independent CPA firm to look at your books and sign and say it looks like you're properly recording things right. Most of the time, they would just say, well, we got our CPA doing the audit. Why don't they just do the tax return? They understand our business the best. And attorneys have always done tax returns because they are in the will process and the trusts and all those kind of things. So they just kind of did returns also. And little by little, it seemed like the enrolled agent just kind of went by the wayside. Well, now lately, we're not getting near enough CPAs in the pipeline to do returns. More and more attorneys are becoming specialized in litigation and real estate and different things, and they don't prepare as many returns. An enrolled agent actually is more specialized in the standpoint that they only do taxes. CPAs do everything else. So what we did is we provided two certificates here at Heartland. Pass an exam with the Internal Revenue Service after taking our courses. You sit for that exam. And you're only taking 1 year of schooling at a community college versus 5 years of schooling at a university. So there's a lot of benefit to this.
Paul, thanks so much for joining us today to talk about taxes. It's a subject that can intimidate some people. But there's so many interesting things that you mentioned today, so much good information, and to hear how Heartland's handling these programs to meet the workforce and give some options to people that they might not have thought of. It's been very enlightening. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Paul Kelson is an instructor of accounting at Heartland Community College. If you liked what you heard today or want other random acts of knowledge on other subjects, subscribe, and you'll hear a new episode just about every week. Thanks so much for listening.